Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. Whether you are a student prepping for tests and boards or a CRNA here to earn CEUs, we are glad you've joined us. For more about us, make sure to check us out on Instagram at Core Anesthesia and online at coreanesthesia.com.
Welcome to the Core Anesthesia Podcast. I'm Sachi.
And I'm Rhea. Together in this care plan series, we're diving into the intricate world of anesthesia, tackling those tough cases that keep you on your toes in the operating room.
As experienced CRNAs with a passion for teaching and mentoring, we're here to break down the complexities of challenging procedures, giving you the need-to-know information.
Each episode, we dissect specific cases, exploring anesthesia techniques, case considerations, pharmacology, and much more.
We've teamed up with Cole and Tanner for these care plan episodes to share our expertise and insights.
So whether you're a student aiming to build a strong foundation or a professional seeking advanced insights, join us as we navigate the intricacies of anesthesia practice. Welcome to another care plan episode. So today we're going to be discussing total hip replacements. So the hip joint is a ball and socket joint, and it's the articulation of the femoral head and the acetabulum. Patients usually need a total hip arthroplasty due to degenerative arthritis, but also hip dysplasias or even trauma. And oftentimes these patients are obese. So there are a few different approaches. You can go posterior, which is the most common, or anterior. Anterior is becoming increasingly more common, or anterior lateral. So Sachi, what are the types of preoperative considerations that you would have for a case like this?
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned that a lot of times these patients have arthritis. So these patients often are a bit old. Due to their arthritis, they have, limited mobility. They're not very active. They also have a lot of pain, so they can be deconditioned. So preoperatively, you really want to be assessing their activity level. How active are they? Can they climb those two flights of stairs? If they can't, clarify, is it due to the pain in the hip or is it due to a cardiac status? Clarify, what pain medications they're taking. A lot of these patients do take Tylenol or Tylenol-containing narcotics. So you want to be cognizant of that so you know whether or not you have room to give your intraoperative IV acetaminophen. Often these patients are on blood thinners or antiplatelets because they are older. They might have had a stent put in the past. So you want to know, when did they take their last blood thinner? Did they hold it? What are our coags? If they have AFib, that should sort of be a trigger to ask about what kind of medications they're on. Typically, every institution is going to have a different protocol. Usually we hold the Plavix at least, 5 days before the surgery. So you want to make sure you ask when they've taken that last. But this can vary based on the surgeon and the cardiac risk factors. And again, if we're going to be doing these cases under regional, like a spinal or neuraxial rather, like a spinal or an epidural, you definitely want to be checking their platelet count and coags, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, absolutely.
With these patients being a bit older, they might have rheumatoid arthritis. So you want to be very cognizant of possible positioning issues you're going to be running into. They might have that limited neck range of motion. They might be very kyphotic. They might be a difficult airway because of that rheumatoid arthritis or just arthritis in general. If you're going to be doing the neuraxial, you want to be feeling their back. You might have scoliosis or unable to position themselves a certain way due to the hip pain. They might not be able to sit up. You might have to do this spinal laterally. Also, the skill of the surgeon is something to take into consideration preoperatively. How quick are they? The reason why this matters is, and as we start to talk about the types of anesthetics for hip replacements, this will make more sense. But how quick the surgeon is affects what type of local you're going to choose for your spinal. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if you're a practicing CRNA, you know which surgeons can do these in an hour, which ones are going to take three. So that's going to, help you decide, are you going to use a quicker, shorter acting local like mepivacaine, or do you need to use Marcaine? Also, does this patient need to go home today? A lot of surgery centers, a lot of hospitals want to get these patients out of the hospital as quick as possible. They don't want them staying overnight. At our hospital, we call these post-op day zeros. That means they want them up they want them leaving the hospital that day. They don't want us giving Marcaine that's going to delay them in PACU and cause a lot of urinary retention, and they have to stay overnight. So you kind of need to know what the post-operative plan for these patients are.
Another thing is, even if the patient isn't going to go home that day, surgeons nowadays want the patient up and walking right away. So if you have given them a lot of really long acting medications that keep them laying in bed, they don't like that. They want them up and mobilizing immediately after surgery.
Mm-hmm. The other thing to consider, especially when you're doing a spinal, preoperatively, you need to be assessing their cardiac status. Whenever we do a spinal, we're very concerned about something like aortic stenosis, right? Because we know that when we do a spinal, their blood pressure can really drop. And with aortic stenosis, we really rely on sort of that increased perfusion pressure. We need to keep their blood pressure higher. So you might need to have a phenylephrine drip ready, you know, primed and programmed, or at least have a stick of phenylephrine in line ready to go. So after you insert that spinal, you're cycling a blood pressure right away, and you're trying to prevent that hypotension, because patients can get nauseous as well if they have that drop in blood pressure. So you want to have your fluids ready, phenylephrine drip ready, syringe. And some people even give Zofran before they do the spinal to sort of help prevent the hypotension. Another thing is, why are they getting their hip replaced? So if this is a trauma patient, you know, and they are in so much pain, you might not be able to move them over from their ER stretcher onto the operating room table to intubate them. You might not be able to turn them laterally to do a spinal. You know, they might just be in so much pain. A lot of people will give ketamine to sort of help with that before they do the spinal, but just really think about that ahead of time. Where are you going to be putting them to sleep? Where are you going to be doing these procedures? Because for intubation and for spinals or epidurals, positioning is absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So once you get into the operating room, what are the next steps? You briefly touched on the types of anesthesia they can give, or neuraxial or GA. You talked about why you might choose one or the other, or types of medications. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and also other types of considerations once you get into the operating room?
Mm-hmm. So we can do these hip replacements a couple of different ways. We can do a single shot spinal, and we can choose our local anesthetic based on the duration of action and how long we need it to last. Anytime we do a spinal, there's a chance, A, it might not work. B, it might not work all the way. It might be patchy. Or C, it wears off too early. You might potentially underdose it, or the surgeon might take a lot longer than you expect, or even they expect, right? So every time you do a spinal, you want to have backup airway stuff readily available, whether that's an LMA. I always have an LMA out, and your ET tube, your general ET tube anesthesia medications, and your airway equipment. So that's really important to have for the single shot spinals. Most commonly, I'm seeing Marcaine, Mepivacaine being used. Some people put narcotic in their spinal as well. When you do a spinal, you also need to sedate them, because yes, while people can absolutely have a spinal and be totally awake for the procedure, that could be totally fine. That's pretty unpleasant for people. Most people want to be asleep. So we typically run a propofol drip. These patients are older. They don't need a lot. A lot of these people are teeny tiny, you know, 85-year-old grandmas who had a fall. So you can get away with 25, 50 milligrams of propofol. So, you know, you don't
have to.
They
just need a nap. They don't need.
Yeah, they just need to sleep.
Yeah. They don't need, we don't need to give them high doses to keep them from moving or to keep them from sensing pain or anything. They've already, that's all taken care of with the spinal. You really just need them to take a nap. And it's really loud in there, hammering, sawing. It's really scary. There's lots of blood everywhere. There's a lot of OR talk, especially with the ortho guys, you know, and girls. So yeah, definitely it's not pleasant to stay awake for this type of procedure.
And just as a side note, if you're writing them on that light propofol drip, you know, just at 25 or 50, sometimes when they get to the hammering and they're really whacking that patient's hip, they will, or even the sawing, the patients might wake up. I've had this happen to me a couple of times where that just jolts, or that noise, or that banging, they open their eyes a little bit and they're like, oh, what's going on? Just be aware. That's happened to a couple of students because they just, you know, they just might be right on the edge there asleep. So neuraxial, you can do the single shot spinal. We don't typically do epidurals for these. You're going to do a spinal. You can do a general anesthetic with a T-tube or even an LMA. If we're putting these patients laterally, the safest thing to do is to protect their airway and use an ET-tube. Some places people also can also do LMAs if the patients are good, you know, candidates for that. But, you know, traditionally we're pretty conservative with the ET-tubes for those. We are not typically going to put A-lines in these patients unless they have, you know, aortic stenosis, severe aortic stenosis or other cardiac status that would warrant an A-line. We don't really need to do a CVP either. We're going to have access to their arms. We can do a second IV if we are starting out with a low hemoglobin. This patient has fallen and they have a big hematoma in their hip and they've already lost, you know, a couple hundred cc's of blood in that hematoma. They're starting off low. Yeah, go ahead and put a second IV in. You can get a type in screen. But for the most part, we just need just that one or two IVs is good.
Yeah. You mentioned also the blood loss that can happen in the hips and thighs. I don't think people realize how much blood you can actually lose in your thighs. Your thighs themselves can hold almost 2 liters of blood.
Wow.
Which is unbelievable. Yeah. So, that's not something to really pass over. You can really have a lot of blood loss and not realize it because it's sitting in that compartment. So you, speaking about blood loss, what is the typical blood loss for a procedure like this? And what are some ways that we can kind of combat that?
So typical blood loss is usually a couple hundred mLs. You know, you could have up to a liter. But a lot of times we're giving TXA or tranexamic acid at the beginning of the case. Some surgeons will even ask for a second dose. This is becoming more and more common. We're giving it an OB more. A lot of surgeons are really giving TXA like candy to prevent blood loss. That is one of the main things that we can do. And again, with the blood loss too, this can happen. You'd be surprised. There's a lot of blood loss that can occur that you don't see in the suction canister. This could be in the field. This could be in the pockets by the surgeon's knees. This could be clotting in the operative area. So if you're starting to notice the patient's getting saggy, they're a little hypotensive, you know, they're not really responding to your phenylephrine pushes, just kind of take a little, you know, walk around the table and kind of see what you got going on over there. Cause the blood loss can be impressive.
All right. So during the case, what are some of the major complications that you could see for a procedure like this?
Some of the biggest complications besides blood loss that I see has to do with hemodynamic instability. And this can be caused for a couple of reasons, one of them being bone cement implantation syndrome. When the surgeon calls for the bone cement and you start to smell that strong, like nail salon type of smell, you know they're mixing the cement. The bone cement binds to the implant and the bone in an exothermic reaction. That's, I think, a board question. You can see bradycardia and hypotension. And there's several different grades of this bone cement implantation syndrome. You see the O2 sat decreasing and you start to notice the systolic blood pressure collapsing, decreasing a little bit. And this can, you know, vary from grade 1 to grade 3, grade 3 being cardiovascular collapse. But sometimes when the bone cement goes in, I'll see the blood pressure drop a little bit. I'll see the O2 sat dip down. I'll hear it go down to like 90, 94, 95. So you can treat this with 100% O2. You treat that blood pressure. Usually you'll see it resolve. But if this gets really bad, you know, you're going to treat this as you would treat any intraoperative embolus. You're going to, you know, you need to do a CVC, an A-line, fluid resuscitate, epi. You're going to treat that as right ventricular failure. It's rare that this level of, you know, catastrophe happens, but when they do the bone cement, you do want to be aware of that because you will potentially see some incidental hemodynamic instability. So you can have a thromboembolism, you could have a fat embolism. So we really want to be cognizant of our end-tidal CO2. We're looking at that hemodynamic instability. We're looking at our heart rate. There's just a lot that can go on intraoperatively when we're working with these big bones, you know, these femurs. So even when we're moving patients, right, they can throw an embolus then at the end of the case. So those are some big complications that we worry about. And then some post-operative considerations. We're wanting to watch for nerve injury. Most commonly, the sciatic nerve is injured in these hip replacements. The surgeon's going to be checking the length of the legs. Sometimes one leg will be longer than the other, but they're really watching for this. That's their job. They're looking for this. Yeah. Bleeding, we've talked a lot about that. And infection is a big one in any total joint. We're going to try to keep these patients normothermic. We want that bear hugger on. And there have been pushback from a lot of surgeons about using the bear hugger intraoperatively. But the studies have shown that it's not really going to increase the infection rate. But you know, if they're going to be dead set on not using the bear hugger, you're going to have to get creative with other ways to keep the patient warm with a fluid warmer, warm blankets.
We actually have this type of patient warmer that's called a hot dog. Have you ever heard of that? But it's basically like a heating mat and you just drape it over the patient. People also have these like water blankets. It goes underneath the patient and it just circulates hot water underneath. But it doesn't matter what the studies say, you are not going to convince an orthopedic surgeon, you know, what's research and what's not. Once they get into their head about what causes infection, what doesn't cause infection, there's no science behind it. You know, save yourself the argument, you know, like Sachi said, find creative ways to keep your patient warm. They're going to fight you on raising the room temperature, which is the best way to keep people warm. So making sure that patients are under a lot of blankets, you know, using those fluid warmers, even as you're using those fluid warmers, making sure that the IV tubing stays underneath those hot blankets as well, because you don't want that fluid to cool off.
And sometimes these surgeons are even really particular about having people come in and out of the room a lot. Especially as a student, you kind of want to be cognizant about, you know, you might see your preceptor outside of the room a bit more versus coming in and out. So that also is a way to reduce infection.
A lot of people want you to come in and out of the sterile core to go into the room, right? Rather than just going from the hallway into the room. Places will even tape off the door. That, like, I worked at a place that literally had a like caution tape, you know, strap that kind of went across the door so nobody can go in and out. They are wearing these big head shields. And, you know, part of it is because the case is really bloody. Another part of it is to decrease infection. They look like spacesuits, space helmets that they're wearing. The drapes are usually going really, really high up over your IV pole to make sure that there's no contamination between anesthesia, anybody else in the surgical field. Yeah. So they are very particular about infection.
You just brought another thing to my mind. Sometimes these surgeons want the bed really up high. And if your patient has a spinal and you have them on a propofol drip, you are going to be doing a lot of airway management. And it's not always an optimal position for you. So I think we can all agree that doing a MAC is harder than doing a general. But in these types of surgeries in particular, it's a lot of airway management. So you want to make sure you have your oral airways out, you have your tongue depressor, you have your suction ready. You want to make sure that you're really prepared to convert to a general. And that is what we want to see when you have your airway set up. We want to know that you're thinking of plan B, C, D, you know, thinking about three steps down the line. So overall, I think we covered a lot. Was there anything else you wanted to add about hip arthroplasties?
Probably the only other thing that I could think of is that, especially when you have those patients that come in because of a fall, a lot of them are usually over, you know, close to 90, over 90, very frail, very frail. So sometimes you might have to do what we call hand-holding anesthesia, where they are getting the very, very bare minimum in order to get through that case. Now, a lot of these patients are not going to be great candidates for surgery, but a lot of the studies do show that if you delay surgical intervention, their mortality rate skyrockets. You know, it's almost guaranteed that they're going to, even if you try to delay, you know, a week to make the patient more optimized, over and over again, the studies will show, no, you need to get the patient to the operating room as soon as possible, even if they are not the healthiest person. So you're going to have those challenges as well. You know, you talked about their cardiac risk stratification. They're just not going to be healthy people. You know, these people are very, very frail. So yeah, I guess the last thing that I would say is there have been cases where I've had to let people, you know, be really light or awake because they were just too sick to put under general or MAC anesthesia.
Yep. And it all comes down to talking to them preoperatively about that and managing their expectations.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
All right, that's all we got for you guys today. We'll see you on the next episode.